Welcome to Worlds Apart. An old Russian joke has it that a pessimist believes that things cannot possibly get worse, while an optimist is confident that they surely can. Just a few decades ago, the Cold War was considered a major existential threat to humanity, but nowadays it looks like a period of deft diplomacy and successful conflict management. Does the situation in Ukraine offer any hopes for this kind of pessimism? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Matthew Croston, Director of Academic Transformation and Professor of National Security at Bowie State University. Dr. Croston, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time and congratulations on such an amazing background.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Now, you and your colleagues have proposed the term the Cold Hot War to denote both the similarities and the differences between the American-Soviet confrontation of the 20th century and the current animosity between Russia and the West. And we still don't know the limits of the current quagmire, but generally speaking, is it more or less manageable as far as you're concerned, compared to the previous round?
I think it's actually more manageable. But what I think many people in the West would maybe be surprised to hear me say, or maybe rather shocked to hear me say, that the more manageable part is actually because of some of the restraint I believe Russia has actually shown during this entire conflict over the last year in Ukraine. Restraint that is where they had opportunity to elevate or escalate the conflict, make it far worse, make it far more transnational, and have not done that, and have continually made decisions to not do that, despite having evidence in their face that might make them prone to think they should. I think that should be that's valuable. We're not capitalizing on that right now in the West, but the fact that it does exist, waiting to be noticed and recognized, is at least a little bit of pessimistic.
Well,
optimism.
Dr. Croston, you said that you are not capitalizing on that in the West, but I think the belief in Russia, and I was yesterday covering one of the major Putin speeches, and I spoke to his press secretary, and he also said that the West is used to taking Russia's restraint as a weakness. And I think many in Moscow are now blaming President Putin for being, if not too soft, then too tolerant and too understanding, too reluctant to use force. And I've heard many people, including his strong supporters, say that hadn't he been so restrained, the war in Ukraine would never have happened. What do you think about that?
I think we have to sort of go back to the beginning in that sense of the conflict itself. And the thing that's been very amorphous, I think maybe both to Russian people and American people, what were the actual end goals of the incursion into Ukraine? If it really was meant to be this sort of classic kinetic traditional war, with the objective being to occupy and take over a country in totality, then that criticism you just mentioned on the Russian side, I think, is accurate. And decisions were not made and actions were not taken to accomplish that goal. But that makes me feel that means that was never the goal in the incursion into Ukraine, that there were more subtle and more nuanced objectives and interests that Russia was trying to obtain and acquire, and largely from the attention of the West. The fact that those have not been accomplished, those have not been acquired, doesn't mean they've given up the hope to really get them done. That's where I've fallen on the idea that the objective is not to occupy Ukraine. The objective is not to own Ukraine. We here in the West, I read it yesterday, you know, coming up on with the anniversary of the conflict, that his objective, of course, was to reestablish the Soviet Union, starting with Ukraine. I hate this comment. I've been railing against this comment for, I think, 15 years. And because the evidence doesn't show that.
Russia has always maintained that the neutrality for Ukraine would be the best option ever. First and foremost for Russia, because that would give Russia a vested interest in keeping Ukraine sovereign and independent, and give Russia a space to breathe between its own forces and NATO forces. But obviously, as we know, And actually, Putin said that yesterday in his major speech that up until the very last moment, we tried to deal with that peacefully. We sent our peace proposals and, you know, the requirements and for security guarantees from NATO and the United States to the Biden administration, and we were flatly refused. Do you think the American people hear that side of the story, that there was an extensive peacemaking effort, an effort by many diplomats to prevent what is happening right now, but the Americans didn't want to engage with that?
No, and I think part of the, there's a lot in what you just said, and there's some deep philosophical questions that I love discussing, but unfortunately, it's incredibly hard to find people in the West willing to have these philosophical discussions. I don't think the problem is all the books behind me. I don't think it's that the Americans are ignorant of certain aspects of Russian history, Russian culture, Russian diplomatic strategy. I think rather, unfortunately, and I've written about this for a long, long time, is that we are still stuck in what I've always called this Cold War pathology, right? In that it behooves us meaning the United States, to see Russia in a particular light, to make sure it stays constrained within a particular relationship. And that relationship doesn't establish any new boundaries, any new definitions. And I think Russia in the 21st century has taken several opportunities to try to see if there would be interest in the West to create new boundaries, to create a new relationship. And as you mentioned, time and time and time again, it would get flatly rejected because we have sort of pushed Russia into this corner ideologically, attitudinally, to say, you're the adversary. We may not be in a formal bipolar ideological Cold War anymore, but we're not going to allow a new relationship to develop with you.
Well, but can I argue with you here? Because you've written yourself that the crucial difference between the Cold War period and the current hotter replay of that period is the fact that during the Cold War, the adversaries were fighting, were engaged in a proxy battle. The actual confrontation, the kinetic confrontation, were far away from their borders. And that was, you know, those were accepted rules of the game. But if we look at the situation in Ukraine and the militarization, accelerated militarization of Ukraine prior to the start of the Russian military operation, if we look at the situation around Taiwan and China, when the United States is pushing ever more promptly inside China, don't you think that it's the United States who actually changed those very rules that you referred to, you know, that Cold War mentality? Because the Cold War mentality, as seen from Moscow right now, was actually a pretty safe framework compared to what we have on our hands right now.
There's a bit of yes or no in that for me, in that it's, I've actually even argued that there's a part cynic within me when I look at the Ukraine conflict over the last year. And I almost see aspects of the leadership, especially within military leadership on both sides, meaning Russia and America, just ignoring the Ukrainian, what I've called actually in different arguments, a Ukrainian proxy war, is there's almost a comfort level in what's been going on in Ukraine for America and Russia, because it's like, ooh, this is so much.
Come on, let's not equate that. I mean, I don't see any comfort here in Russia because we are losing our soldiers and our society is bleeding.
Well, no.
Your society is not incurring the same losses.
Keep in mind, there's always a difference between what people on the street may feel and what the leadership that makes.
No, my point is that it's far more direct and visceral for us than it is for you at this point.
No, without doubt. I'm talking from that strategic perspective, though. For example, I think at least in the beginning, before things started to go very, very ugly on the Russian side in this conflict, the acceptance of, because I could never get around the idea of why is Russia sort of allowing, quote unquote, allowing all of these weapon systems, all of this lethal aid into Ukraine, plus advisors to help Ukraine train with the system.
Well, so I can answer that very easily for you, having a last name Boyko, because Ukraine, yes, it's a sovereign country and it's an independent country, but most of us Russians have family there. And an idea of authorizing a military operation there for a long time was incomprehensible. I'm sure even to Putin himself. Sure, he is the commander-in-chief, but declaring a military operation or a war on Ukraine is, you know, I think is the biggest sin of his political career. And I mean that in a moral sense. He was pushed to commit it, but because he's, after all, the president. But I'm sure this is the last thing he ever wanted to do.
I think there could be both of this. I think he can feel that emotionally, but there's also, to me, without a doubt, especially within the halls of D.C., within Washington, D.C., there was a recognition in the importance of this conflict that Russia hadn't felt from the West in quite some time. Instead of constantly being rejected, constantly being dismissed, constantly being shoved to the side as an also-ran or not as important anymore, China's replacing you as the top priority. There's a certain level of recognition in this ugliness that is actually, maybe I shouldn't have used the word comfortable, but there's an acknowledgement being this, and now you notice us. Mm-hmm.
Come on, isn't that the American the American narcissism on its full display? We don't care about what you think about us. Seriously, I mean, you may have this background of books, but we actually read them. I mean, Russians are just as proud of themselves as the Americans are, and I mean, at this point, I think we have nothing to be ashamed of or to seek the American recognition in that sense, because the wisdom of American foreign policy and what has America done to the world is not something that we seek.
No, I understand that completely. And it's sort of misinterpreting what I'm saying in the sense that it's not about seeking the acknowledgement because I feel good if the Americans recognize me, but rather it's the understanding that good or bad, oftentimes bad, in a unipolar or aspiring to be unipolar system, America calls a lot of these shots by hook or by crook, and you have to get acknowledgement from that unipolar power in order to get onto the stage. Well, and there was an aspect of this is the only, I mean, no one I think can deny, and I've had this fight with Americans for the last year constantly. If you ask most Americans on the street, they'll say, when did this begin? Well, they'll say a year ago, when Russia invaded Ukraine. And for them, that really is part, that's point A. And it's so far away from being point A that that's part of this problem, that we're not addressing the true root causes and foundations where these conflicts emerged from and why.
Can I ask you one more question? And I think you are onto something when it comes to the American perception of themselves as, being a unipolar power, which I don't think corresponds to reality, to the present day reality anymore. But you've written that in dealing with Russia's sensibilities in Ukraine, the Americans have forgotten about their own Monroe doctrine. And I wonder if it's indeed a lapse of memory or whether it is actually a pretty conscious commitment or pledging allegiance to a Latin phrase, quid licet Jovi, non licet Bovi. What's allowed to the gods is not allowed to the cattle. Isn't that what the Americans are trying to tell us?
Well, I think a word that always comes into my mind often when we talk about these issues is there is absolutely aspects of this that sort of smack of sort of a reckless hubris on the part of the Americans, in the sense that I don't consider it, again, to be ignorant. I think I see purposeful intent behind many maneuvers, which always sort of confound me sometimes. Something I intend to write about but haven't yet is I worry a little bit about what I've called the fetish of Versailles. And I'm a little concerned, for example, like, what's our goal? All right, we talked about what are the goals of Russia in this incursion with this conflict, but what is the West trying to accomplish? Is it peace by any means necessary? Is it peace with all options on the table, which is what I think it should be? Or, and this is what I'm more worried about, is it peace only with punishment? Because that's what the Americans right now, I think, are really obsessed by, and they think they have their own people behind this endeavor.
But Dr. Croston, very quickly, is peace even part of the equation here? Because many people in Moscow believe that the Americans are making a bet on a prolonged conflict. They want to indeed not just punish, but undermine their strategic enemy by, essentially outsourcing all the human losses to the Ukrainians. And geopolitically, it's not that, bad of a deal. Do they actually want peace?
Well, this is one of those really ugly, fudgy things in philosophy where we're like, there's a fungibility about peace and how each side defines it. I think the Americans will absolutely say with a straight face to you, we absolutely want peace, but peace on our terms and how we define it. And how we define that peace, I'm not sure how many Russians would think that's peace at all.
One thing we can definitely agree upon is that we need to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Matthew Croston, Director of Academic Transformation and Professor of National Security at Bowie State University. Dr. Croston, we are recording this interview just days after Russia formally announced its suspension of the New START Treaty, which, when it was signed back in 2010, was an attempt by both Moscow and Washington to use that old Cold War era framework of arms reduction talks and try to adapt it to present day realities. The fact that this one of the last agreements, remaining agreements between our countries, is now formally put on hold, what does it tell you about both the nature of the historic moment and the state of relationship between our countries?
To be honest with you, I find the talk, and here in the West, people are obsessed by this suspension of the START Treaty. And they're taking it to extremes as far as what it is, what it symbolizes in terms of Russian intentions, meaning, is this the smoking gun we've been looking for as far as Russia wanting to start World War III? And I've never been, I'll just admit my own personal bias up front. I've never been a huge proponent of thinking that the START Treaty is a huge accomplishment in real terms. Because the fact is, both sides, it's a strategic reduction of nuclear arms that are held and a promise not to do any more nuclear tests, a ban on nuclear testing. All right, so if you suspend yourself temporarily while intimating you could return under certain conditions into the START Treaty later, and it's directly after Biden does his quote-unquote secret visit to Kyiv, which I do want to talk a little bit about, but and where he pledges another $500 million in lethal aid to Ukraine. If you ask me, and this is the problem I have here in the West, people are only focusing on the announcement that came after that of suspending the START Treaty. Look at how bad that guy is. When I'm like, but what prompted it? What prompted it as a symbolic gesture to say, if you're only escalating this conflict, I have to do something even larger in your mind and your historical memory to make you realize how important this is to us.
Putin also said that the longer are the ranges of weapons that are being supplied to Ukraine by the West, the further into the Ukrainian territory, or actually the further Russia will have to sort of strike back. And the question I want to ask you is, he didn't draw the line beyond which Russia will not be able or will, you know, hold itself from striking, but what do you think are Russian red lines? Do you think Russia would attempt to strike beyond Ukraine or perhaps even beyond Europe? Because, I mean, if you look at Russia's strategic options, there's not much left and we still have to fight.
I'm in the minority in this. I'm a bit alone out here in the United States when I say the following. I don't think Russia will do that simply because I don't actually believe there have been obvious opportunities over the last 12 months where Russia could have been extremely reckless. That's not to say in war there isn't recklessness on both sides all the time, but there was an absolutely opportunities where you, what you're talking about could have taken place, and the Russian Federation passed on that opportunity to be that reckless. To me, that was conscious. To me, that was voluntary. That was intentional. So going beyond, I think the red line discussion is really important, but not necessarily in the way you mentioned. Like, I think it was the failure of the West to ever take Russian red line seriously that sort of propelled us into this problem to begin with.
Dr. Crossan, I absolutely agree with you. But the problem is that, as you mentioned, during the visit to Kyiv, Biden once again announced additional military aid to Ukraine. And we are now hearing, I mean, this is also happening on the back of Munich Security Conference, which produced some extremely belligerent statements, like the one coming from the British Prime Minister, who said that, you know, you guys should not be concerned about sending weapons to Ukraine because those weapons were intended for Russia anyway. So Russia was our enemy, for many, many years before this operation. When you hear something like that, and I agree with you that Russia doesn't want a war, and it's pretty clear that Putin is a pretty responsible leader, but there comes a point when if the other side is not held by any fear, you need to bring that fear to its land so that the officials will be somehow brought back to reality.
Well, there's always this fundamental problem, and I've had, again, it's very difficult right now because of the current state of Russian studies in America and the current state of Russian expertise in Washington, D.C. is extremely sort of suffering to me from tunnel vision and extremely narrow-minded in terms of what possibilities exist. And therefore we miss, purposely in my opinion, we miss the opportunities that are presented to us to show the other side, the Russian Federation side, is willing to work with us. We always portray it as they're recalcitrant, they're stubborn, they won't move, they won't budge, we're working with them. But it's not true. When we look at this whole NATO stuff, lack of a better term, Estonia is in NATO, Latvia is in NATO, Lithuania is in NATO, Poland is in NATO, Hungary is in NATO. All of these things Russia didn't like, but it didn't do anything. It let it go. And all along they said, but just listen, remember, Ukraine has to be a no-go. Please believe us when we tell you Ukraine is a no-go. And we just simply sort of shamelessly flirted with the fact that, well, we don't really intend to put Ukraine in NATO. We'll listen to you enough for that. But to flirt with them and make them think they might get invited so that then they don't want to pay attention to you.
Well, and it's not just flirting. It's sending weapons and training soldiers and also pouring lots of money in into propaganda and turning the Ukrainian population very virulently antagonistic to Russia. I mean, it's a very purposeful effort to create a hostile state on Russia border, a state that used to have before this operation, I think the second largest army in Europe after the Turkish army.
Well, I'll give you a little bit of personal history. Way back when, say 1998, when I was beginning my doctoral studies, I was part of a group on the outside looking in. But there was, at that time, there was a very strong group in Western Europe that talked about because that was when we were really discussing NATO expansion in its infancy. And they talked about, let's start with Russia. Let's find a way to get Russia into NATO, and then we'll work our way back towards Western Europe and include, because if Russia's in NATO, it won't mind all the other countries being in NATO either. And then we'll have this massive defense or treaty organization there on the continent, going from Western Europe all the way to East Asia, for lack of a better term. And it ultimately failed. And I'll never forget this because I was so into the idea at the time, being young and inexperienced, but it was obvious that on the Western side, they really didn't know, why should we exist if Russia's part of our organization?
Well, Mr. Crossan, Dr. Crossan, I think it's not only you who were young and inexperienced. President Putin himself, in one of his interviews, said that he asked that question. I think he addressed it to President Clinton, and he didn't receive an answer. And he's been suspecting for many, many, many years, coming to 2022, that the West, it's not just a matter of, historic prejudice or, you know, putting American shadow onto Russia and keeping it as an evil figure for, you know, geopolitical or political reasons. I think the fear here in Moscow is that the West really wants to, destroy Russia, for the lack of a better term. And in fact, they're pretty direct, the American officials now are pretty direct about the need to make Russia suffer a strategic defeat. How do you understand that? What's the end game from the American side, as far as you're concerned?
I've written about this actually for a long time, and it was well before the invasion, the conflict in Ukraine. So I've seen this trend far extant to Ukraine. It isn't just about Ukraine. It existed before that. And unfortunately, I've never been given any countering evidence to the idea that two American decision makers, American power brokers, the best position to America for Russia is, you can exist, we'll let you exist.
On our terms.
You can be part of the global community, but only on bended knee, right? You have to be below, because that's what makes the world safer in that mentality. And trying to show opportunities to create new relationships when there are significant power brokers who think that way has been a very frustrating journey of about 25 years.
Well, you call it frustrating, but I mean, on moral and ethical grounds, and it's not like people are concerned with morals these days, but still, I mean, isn't it deeply offensive to you as a human being? Because I mean, if you treat any country like that, that they can only exist if they fully subscribe to your terms, isn't that utterly xenophobic? Isn't that racist?
Being a national security intelligence guy, we learn very quickly in our world, we often have to depart from those discussions just because otherwise we'll drive ourselves insane, because we often deal with issues that are not very moral and not very just. And to me, the problem is we give examples of the relationship that we could and should have with the Russian Federation, because Russia only needs to look at neighbors and say, well, do you agree with everything in the United States? Do you agree with everything that Saudi Arabia does? No. Do you agree with everything that China does? No. Do you actively work and cooperate with them across a whole host of cross interests? Yes, you do. Well, why can't you do that with us? We're not going to agree with everything. Some things will be actually very adversarial to each other about, but there's a number of issues that we agree on, and we should be able to establish alliances and cooperative behavior. Mm-hmm. We have a time and time and time again, we've passed on that opportunity.
You know, one of the things we used to agree upon, I'm not sure we still agree on that, is the golden rule: treat others as you want to be treated. And unless the Americans learn it, they are up for, a humbling and humiliation that they want to visit upon other countries. That's just my opinion, but we have to live it there.
Let me just say one last point real quick. It's just, again, we have to try to, on the American side, we have to be at least aware of things that look, devoutly hypocritical. When you have Secretary of State Blinken just the other day, when China was promising maybe it will consider giving lethal aid to Russia, Blinken came out and said, this is reckless, this is dangerous, this is horrible for China to talk this way, while for the last year, he's been doing that very thing in Ukraine. If we're not aware of what that looks like to other sides, we're always going to be creating more problems than we can solve.
Couldn't agree with that more, but we still have to call it quits right now. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Oksana.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.